The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Seneca Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from a pop-up Chinese studio here in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, joined this week by David Moser, Academic Director of the CET program here in Beijing. How are you on this crisp and lovely fall afternoon?
Oh, feeling groovy, Kaiser, if I may be anachronistic.
29 was the PM 2.5 reading as we had coffee earlier.
Yeah.
Lovely.
The same age as the woman sitting next to us, I think.
I wish. I have a question for you, Dave. If you had to come up with a mission statement for this little podcast of ours, for the Seneca Podcast, how would you encapsulate it?
Well, China is a very complex place, right? So I suppose we try to provide some framing for certain events so that people can have a better understanding. Maybe point focus in on certain things that might be useful. But I think maybe your presence here makes its function more to sort of go against some prevailing narratives that we see.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I definitely want to make at least people aware of the narratives that are in place. I mean, both Chinese narratives and those that dominate in mostly English-speaking countries, right, where so many of our listeners are.
Some which may be implicit.
Right. Yeah. So I think the length and the format and the fairly kind of focus of the show allow for unpacking of more complicated issues. Yeah, so right. Maybe it's like our mission statement is to move listeners toward a both broader and deeper understanding of China, and looking not only at events as they unfold, but also the historical and cultural context out of which they grow, right?
Right.
So with that in mind, I think we're delighted to welcome to the show today Fokke Obama, who is a veteran Dutch journalist with their Volkskrant, which is a very popular newspaper in the Netherlands. He's the author of the brand new book, China and the West, Hope and Fear in the Age of Asia, which I think was undertaken very much in the spirit of this podcast, many of the same goals. So Fokke, welcome to Seneca and congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much.
So would you agree this is the spirit of in which the book was undertaken?
Yes, absolutely. The origins of the book go back to 2008, mm-hmm. when I first visited China, and I was just impressed by the dynamism and the energy of the place, and it's compared positively with my own country and Europe in general, where the credit crisis just had started, and pessimism was largely spread, and also very negative attitude towards China. China was going to take over Europe and was going to dominate the world, and this would be a very bad thing. And I thought, we need a sort of cool down and think straightforwardly about, what is exactly the impact of China, the rise of China, which is, of course, the main event of this century, on our part of the world. And so I tried a balanced approach in this book, and in that sense, it's like your show.
Oh, great. I have to admit that I don't read any languages besides English and Chinese, so I don't really think that I'm in a position to speak on what the narratives are that dominate European coverage. I don't read German or French or Italian or Spanish or any or for that matter Dutch, of course. Google Translate only takes you so far. How would you characterize? You said they're coming for us. They're going to deprive us of economic opportunities. What are some of the other narratives that you think dominate in discussions in European media?
Well, I think underlying most stories is a sense of fear for China, and it goes back to this old yellow peril view of China, you know, this 1.3 billion people, and when they are moving towards us, you know, what's going to happen to us? And you see that in every story, for instance, on takeovers, you know, there has to be only one single Chinese businessman taking over a Dutch soccer club, and then everybody starts to get a little shaky about it. And it's completely exaggerated. You know, if there's activity of China in the Rotterdam harbor, then it's the same thing. Or if Chinese take over French wine chateaus, you know.
Which is a large part of your book is devoted to that, that you reported out of Bordeaux, right?
Well, it's a nice place to be, so.
Yeah.
But as a reporter, it's kind of interesting that you chose this stance or this focus for the book, because it seems to me a lot of reporters, some of the ones that we might go against their prevailing narratives here on the show, are more engaged in sort of producing articles that go with the narrative, because that's how they get published and that makes their editors happy.
Yeah.
But you in the book, and you seem to be expressing a feeling that you have felt pushback against what another narrative you were trying to present in the Dutch press, right?
Yes. Well, the thing is, I had this opportunity of having a sabbatical year, and then you have also the opportunity to stand back a little from what you're doing in daily life.
Yeah, right.
And so I could see, you know, the way Western media were behaving. And I have to emphasize, it's not only against China. It's looking for problems and for conflicts, which is general, I think, to Western media. And I mean, to have critical journalism is, of course, very important, but for a change, I also was interested in being more constructive, and so that's why I also started to criticize my own fellow journalists.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask one other question?
Of course.
I always assume that the European discourse is pretty much the same as the Anglophone discourse, but maybe not. One phenomenon that we have that we talk a lot about are these division into two parties or two camps of what we call dragon slayers and panda huggers. And we have these certain authors that we could list who fall into one or the other category.
Yeah.
And it's also in academia, because you could list the same sort of professors who speak on all the podcasts and things. I won't name names right now, but do you have the same phenomenon there in academia as well as journalism?
Yes, I think you can make that distinction. And while my effort is trying not to be in one of these right. categories and stay as
studied
objective
and neutral, yeah.
as much as possible. I have to admit, nowadays I'm interviewed because of my book by Chinese journalists, and I'm giving sour and sweet comments on both China and the West. And they
like sweet and sour here.
I was going to say that.
Yeah, but they tend to...
Tasty cuisine.
They tend to take the sweet remarks on China and the sour remarks on the West. And then you don't get the whole picture.
So. It's always a danger, right? I mean, anything that you say is going to be cherry-picked by the Chinese media and they'll be
but
very
I mean,
selective.
That's of course something we in the West do as well. I mean, that's not really different. The difference is, of course, that behind the Chinese journalist, there is the Chinese state.
Right. Now, you use this word, this phrase, the West, to designate presumably a set of nations that have a shared set of political and maybe economic norms. And it's something that I very studiedly avoid using. I tend not to deploy the word the West or the phrase the West. You don't experience any kind of pushback against this idea that there is a West. I mean, you know, you try using it sometime in a group of academics or in a group of journalists. If you talk about the Western media, the hackles are immediately up.
That's a difficult argument. I mean, can you talk about China then? You know, because
China is a definable nation state.
But can you talk about Europe? Because Europe is also, you know, we are 29 nations, and
right.
it's very divided.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, in fact, the book originally was called China and Europe.
Mm.
But my English publisher, they didn't like very much Europe in the title of the book for commercial reasons. So it has been brought into China and the West, and that's the main reason I speak of the West.
Okay.
I think also a journalist like Foka is to be forgiven because this is a category the Chinese themselves tend to deal with much more than even we do.
Right, and that's usually when you encounter the hackle-raised.
Exactly. Thing. And as we mentioned over lunch, some Chinese even considered Japan to be part of the West.
Yeah.
I think there's an argument to be made for that. It is, after all, a liberal, democratic, capitalist state. But I want to understand better who the intended reading audience of this is. Who do you imagine is going to see this book and want to buy it?
Yeah, well, it's not meant for specialists, first of all. It's the general public. It's basically the kind of public I'm used to writing for this newspaper.
You have it in Dutch as well?
Yes, there is a 2013 edition, which is called China and Europe.
Okay.
It's a very broad public. Everybody who's asking the question, what does this rise of China mean for us? Mm-hmm. And I think it's also interesting for Chinese people because it gives you an idea of how we in the West or Europe.
Let's go ahead and use the West for now. I mean, we decided that's what we're going to be comfortable in. Yeah, you set out to do something I think that's just very ambitious and very praiseworthy. You're not just trying to build a more nuanced understanding of China realities here on the ground, but also you want to urge readers toward a better awareness of their own prejudices, their own biases, what you call pride and prejudice in the book, right? Which I think is an interesting use of the phrase. The whole first chapter that you talk about, reckoning with your own prejudices, mm-hmm. your own pride in your European systems, the institutions, and the values you have as a Western European. You also talk about a kind of sudden epiphany that you have while attending an otherwise very boring conference in Brussels, and yet another one of these, when a cranky Chinese professor just starts in on a rant. Was that a narrative device, or was that a real awakening moment for you?
Well, that was a real awakening moment, and I remember that moment very
vividly,
clearly, vividly, because everybody watching him, and it was a mixture of European and Chinese specialists. They were a bit confused because he was so outspoken and negative on Europe, which is of course, as we felt it, an un-Chinese way of behaving. Mm-hmm. Which is always diplomatic and polite and, hoping for mutual understanding and win-win situations, etc. And he was completely against that. So for me, as a beginner in China knowledge, it was quite astonishing to see someone so outspoken and negative about Europe. So,
and this was in what year? What year was this?
This was 2009 or something.
Okay. Like that. I mean, because, it's interesting. I think a lot of people would say that there was a major change in the year 2008, that mm-hmm. 2008 really marked the watershed. And there was this, very kind of heavily freighted symbolic moment. The Beijing Olympics happened. They opened on August 8th. And then just literally 3 weeks after the closing of the closing ceremony of the Beijing Games, was the Lehman Brothers collapse.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. And so these were two kind of, a passing of the torch maybe in the minds of some people, and that you suddenly heard a lot more of that kind of swagger, that assertiveness, that almost, pugnaciousness coming out of China. Would you agree that that was kind of an inflection point?
I absolutely agree. And I think at that point, Chinese authorities really thought, we are the future, and look at the West. They are going down the drain. And I mean, I have to be honest, we in the West thought the same. We thought, with the credit crisis, I mean, it was so unpredictable what would happen. So we somehow lost our confidence then. Mm-hmm. I think events afterwards, make clear that the picture is not that black and white.
Right, of course not.
It seems to me, and the larger, even pre-2008, the arc of this has been from China, China thinking of itself as a country or a civilization state or whatever, that was joining the geopolitical order and becoming a part of it and an equal or even superior player, to a very different sort of mentality that we have now under Xi Jinping, which is we're not just joining the geopolitical order. We are creating our own new geopolitical order. You know,
yes.
creating a, you know, one belt, one road. We're bypassing the geopolitical order and forging a new model. You know, this idea of a new model. Do you see that as part of the, you know, what, it's at least a subtext for the Chinese focus of what's going on?
Yeah. Well, it's very interesting. We in the West have been asking for a responsible stakeholder all the time, and a more active attitude of China. So now we get it. And of course, we are, you know, not sure whether this is what we asked for. And I think AIIB, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, is a very interesting example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've done a show on that. It's
I think China did diplomatically a very interesting move. And the U.S. Failed to understand the attractiveness of the Chinese proposition. At the same time, you should not exaggerate the importance of the AIIB. I mean, geopolitically, there's also, of course, the Pacific. And I think in that issue, China is not moving so smartly as they did on the AIIB.
Mm-hmm. Much of your book is concerned with these kind of dueling senses of superiority, mm-hmm. right? That's a theme that threads through of two civilizations, really. Each kind of supposing a kind of exceptionalism for itself. So there's this young friend of mine here, a guy named Greg Blandino. He works for an internet company here, and he once commented, and I thought it was really, really kind of, you know, preternaturally wise to say that he was answering a question on Quora about, you know, which culture is more, you know, has a greater sense of superiority. And he said that, you know, the U.S. and China are both really big on exceptionalism. I mean, he wasn't talking about the West. He was talking about the United States in particular, but of very different kinds of exceptionalism. American exceptionalism claims that its values are universal, that it should be the norm and the form for the entirety of the world, while China's exceptionalism is rooted in a very different belief, one that's perhaps equally arrogant, that China's culture, China's values are unique, are inimitable.
And unexportable.
And not exportable, right. Yeah. I mean, what do you think of this idea? I mean, is this something that you encountered that might resonate with you?
Yeah, I think I agree. And the U.S. is absolutely convinced of it, of the values. And of course, me as a European, I share these values as well. But the U.S. is just sending out this signal all the time that this is the case, and we are less in that habit.
Europeans,
in Europe, China. I think the interesting thing is it's a civilization on its own, but what comes with this feeling of superiority is also a feeling of inferiority.
Yeah, you talk about that a lot. Also, I mean, I remember in particular you were talking about somebody who's studying Chinese communities in Europe and says that they were very much characterized by this simultaneous superiority complex and inferiority complex. Right?
Exactly. And I think if you have to understand the Chinese mindset, I mean, these two notions have come into play. And you see that this inferiority complex, which is, of course, driven by the century of humiliation in the 19th century, is very much there. And it also makes, you know, for a kind of feeling of revenge and wanting to do better.
It's our turn again, right?
Yeah, this time it's our turn. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, one of the senses of superiority in those communities he was talking about, you know, the work ethic, for example.
Absolutely.
This is something I remember. You know, our co-host Jeremy, who unfortunately couldn't join us right now, was he's always talking about how you know, he's sort of shocked at going to Europe and businesses that close at 5 p.m. Or that close on weekends or on, you know, in Southern Europe, especially on every goddamn feast day for the Catholic Church has. How can they compete? You know, you go to China and banks are open on weekends and many businesses are 24 hours and nobody would think of them. Yeah, it's.
But what I would like to point out then is that when you look at the hour productivity, so the productivity per worked hour in European countries is far higher
yes,
than
absolutely.
In China. So maybe China should come a bit more
Oh, I agree.
To the European
as a working stiff, I absolutely agree. More vacation time, more work-life balance.
Yeah, yeah.
Another theme that's I think an important one we should maybe spend some time unpacking. You know, you look like you said at that 19th century mainly at this sort of narrative of humiliation at the hands of imperial powers that China suffered for so long, and something I think is like familiar to the point of banality to China watchers. Now, history is obviously very important toward an understanding of contemporary Chinese attitudes. But in your book, you also urge people, like I said, to appreciate their own historical legacy, their own privileges, as you say, how it shapes the lens through which they view China. So what do you see as the main elements of the Western historical experience that you think have created these kinds of distortions when they view China? What are the chapters where's the lack of awareness? I certainly have ideas.
You have to point out the lack of awareness, right? Most of all, I mean, for instance, the century of humiliation. I think that the average European, you know, they don't know what you're talking about. They completely forgot about this black chapter of European colonialism in China. Whereas here it's very much a vivid thing, but we ignore it, and we basically reduce China to, you know, an opportunity to reach a big market for companies.
Interesting.
But there is very, very little intellectual curiosity towards, you know, the Chinese culture, the Chinese political system broader. You know, it's always simplified. For instance, the political system, we simplify it to
authoritarian human rights violators who write.
Yeah, but also given the economic success of China, you know, an effective way of dealing with the economy. Whereas if you're closer to China and you're inside it, you know that there is a real problem of, you know, the way the Chinese authorities are dealing with their economy, and that there should be fundamental change. But when you're really far back, you know, you think, okay, these guys, they have 10% growth, 7% growth. That's fantastic. You know, it's very simplified.
It might be worth just mentioning the thing that might be a cliche by now, is Susan Shirk's observation when she came out with her book, China, a Fragile Superpower, that when she told her American friends the title of her book, they said, fragile?
Yeah, exactly.
How is it fragile? And when she told her Chinese friends the title, they said, superpower? We a superpower? No.
So, right. I mean, although it would be very different now. It would be very different now. I think if you were to talk to people, you know, right now the narrative is about Chinese fragility. You look at the papers, they're full of stories about the crack-up, about, you know, the economic disorder.
Oh, in the West, that there is a mention,
that's
of
right, but no, and also, if you talk to Chinese now...
Well, they always have that. That's the point. They always thought of themselves as fragile.
No. I'm talking about in the West, the narrative is about economic decline in China, right, about the end of this period of growth. You know, I mean, Gordon Chang is riding high in the saddle again, and I mean, there's a lot of this declinist narrative now being applied to China.
Right.
And conversely, a very strong sense among a lot of Chinese, if you talk to them in the wake of the parade, they can now confidently pronounce, "Yep, superpower." I mean, it's amazing how
term of a new "新型大国关系," a new.
Well, that's different.
What's the English phrase?
It's right.
New form of superpower relation.
Major power relationship.
A new form.
Yeah, but you know, this is formulation. This is addressed directly to the Thucydides trap. God, that's hard. The Thucydides trap. Right. You know, this idea that a rising power must necessarily disrupt an existing order, and it will lead inevitably to conflict. And, you know, people have looked at rising powers over the history of humanity since the time of, you know, the Peloponnesian War,
right,
and have, I think, in most instances seen that there has been conflict. And so, I mean, very clearly, you know, intended to steer clear.
I think you have to consider in that case the fact that we have nuclear capacities on both sides.
That's right.
And that makes it quite different from all these historic examples.
Mm-hmm. There's a, because of this thing we mentioned, the different notion of Chinese exceptionalism, that the language they will tend to use, we tend to see this as a threat because, as Kaiser said, we tend to think of our trajectory as being universal, that these values that we're moving towards, China says, no, you know, we're exceptional. And that makes it very easy for them to say, no, there's no conflict here. There's no Thucydides trap. This is a win-win situation. We respect each other. We have mutual respect. We go our way, you go your way, and there's no problem. We just do what we can do in conjunction with each other, right?
Different ideas of modernity, different paths to modernity.
But do you think the problem is that the we hear that in the West, but nobody buys it?
Well, I mean, is
it reasonable to buy it, or are they just being duplicitous? They actually do want the same thing we do, which is the next big superpower, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a bit difficult to state that there is no conflict if you look at the Pacific, where.
Right.
I mean, there is clearly a conflict of interest. I mean, the question
China
is the South China Sea, East China Sea. The big question is how can you solve it? And China is trying to solve it by changing the facts on the ground silently while stating there is a peaceful rise. But I think that that's not a very clever strategy. If you look at the reaction of neighboring countries who seek their military alliance with the U.S. more and more.
Do you believe they see it differently, really? Or do you think they're just lying? I mean, they claim they see...
Who can really second guess that?
I don't know. I mean, it's a serious question. Do you think that they really believe their historical account of Chinese terror? Do they really believe that or not, do you think?
I think it's just a very big power seeking more power in the world, and I think that is the way you have to analyze it. And then there is of course a lot of rhetoric. I mean, if you listen to Xi Jinping in the United Nations, you know, it's all peaceful and coexistence and very nice. But I mean, that's diplomacy.
Right. So on the subject of history, I mean, there's an idea that's been really kind of formulating in my mind for quite some time. I'm also in the business of trying to explain, or not to explain so much as to urge people toward a more informed empathy about China, to be able to put yourself in those shoes. And, you know, as somebody who holds Western values, I very much do. I'm, you know, as much a creature of the Enlightenment as, you know, Asian American, as a white American, I embrace those values. I like, you know, secular democracy. I like all the values of the Enlightenment, you know. Mm-hmm. And the thing about empathy as a position is that you do not need to abdicate those values in order to understand how somebody else may see the world. That's the great thing. I do not abate or surrender those values that I hold so dearly when I do that.
It doesn't collapse into relativism.
Right. It doesn't collapse immediately into relativism. So, but one thing that's become more and more obvious to me is that it's not just a lack of understanding on the part of Europeans and North Americans about China's history. It's a lack of understanding of their own history. I think that what people forget, what they fail to recognize, is the extent to which the values that we all hold are the product of an historical process that is not universal, that is actually very quite particular, that only happened in that one far western jagged little peninsula sticking off the Eurasian landmass, and only happened in certain countries of that. I mean, it didn't happen in the Iberian Peninsula. It happened in France and in England and in the Netherlands and not Greece. It didn't happen. It happened only in the Protestant. I'm talking about the Enlightenment. I'm talking about the Reformation, and, you know, I'm talking about what happened.
But you're not talking about human rights here.
I ultimately am, because human rights, you know, when did the Declaration of the Rights of Man come out? I mean, that this was something that very much was a product of the Enlightenment, and also now it happens that I think that those values ultimately should be. I have a normative field. Should be universally.
And they have an appeal. Universal.
I do believe that they do. But as to how to get there, mm-hmm. we have to understand that, you know, we have come in the West, and this is really what I'm getting to. We have come in the West to, you know, hold even more closely this idea that there is a goal-directed history. It's like the way that a lot of people think about evolution. We're not clear on the concept. We think that, you know, eyes, for example, were an inevitable evolutionary right. development, that they ought to have been that way. No, that's not how evolution works. That's not how history works. There isn't an inherent teleology. There isn't a goal directedness baked into it. I think rather we stumbled on something through a lot of historical, you know, difficulties and a lot of blood left on the road to this. But there are a lot of different roads that could have been chosen. The one that the West walked ended up in a terrific place. I mean, I think with a very, very a great set of values, great set of political institutions, a great set of economic ideas. But these are not the norm for the entire world. And to expect that the rest of the world can now cross that historical chasm with great ease is just simply unrealistic. And we need to think about getting from A to B and not, you know, I mean, you know, in a way that doesn't leave a lot of blood on the road.
Yeah. I mean, it's for sure that, for instance, the concept of democracy is not bought everywhere. For if you take Iraq, the US has tried to impose it. It didn't work. At the same time, I think there is this universal appeal. If you ask a Chinese peasant whether he wants democracy, I mean, there's so much propaganda against democracy that he probably would say no. But if you ask him, you know, do you want to have a say about what is going on in your village, he would say yes. So which comes down to democracy.
Yeah, I was looking through the index to your, or the chapters for your book, and then just out of curiosity, I was looking through the index of a book by Zhang Weiwei, which I know Kaiser hates, but he's this strident nationalist writer, you know, writes in English. I mean, he's published it translated into English. I was looking at his index, and whereas...
Hates not a sufficient word.
Hates not a
loathes, despises.
Anyway, and to see... what kinds of framing or what kind of focus is in the index, it's all on what I think was the Chinese more interested in, not human rights, but on GDP, on development, on bringing people out of poverty, on economic success, on economic progress.
False dichotomy.
False dichotomy, but that is their focus, right? If you mention human rights, they will mention we brought 500 million people out of poverty, right?
Absolutely.
Is that, but that's a valid, at least that's a valid, it may not be binary that one can't come without the other. But still, it's at this stage of historical development, it's a valid point.
It's
right?
It's a very valid point. I mean, and I think there is not enough recognition of that in Western countries. You know, that if you look at who has contributed most towards fighting poverty in the world, that is for sure it's China.
Right. You take China out of the equation, the poverty levels remain flat.
Yeah, almost. Yes. Yes. Yeah. So I totally agree with that. But then. Social, economic, human rights, as you mentioned, are very important. But it wouldn't mean that the political and the individual rights are not important. So,
and I think this is kind of the nub of your book. Like, I mean, if I may, just like, maybe I'm wrong, but I think that you see like a dyad between, on the one hand, a kind of relativist approach. There are people that you talk to, you know, like Schmidt, for example, and then somebody else who is kind of a universalist. And your inner dialogue through this book is about how do we engage China on the issue of human rights? That's a lot of what you end up talking about. I mean, where you seem to be most conflicted in the book is in this, right?
Well, where I'm still struggling with, and
as we all ought to be, right.
Which I think is also, you know, from an analytical point of view, very different, difficult to come up with some kind of solution. Is this point? And well, if you take it to the political level, we have these politicians who go to China, European politicians. They express things about human rights behind closed curtains. That's what they tell us, and we have to believe them. But we never see any results. The other way around, if they do it openly, and you know the Chinese lose face, it might have an adverse impact on, for instance, cases of political prisoners they come up for, as you know, Chinese authorities really don't like losing face in public. So what is the right approach? You know,
what's the right yardstick? What's the right measurement? I mean, is it efficacy? Is it what actually changes, or is it you know, being consistent with our own values? Which is more important? Or is this, again, a false dichotomy?
Well, I think being consistent with your own values is really important. You now have an opposition in Europe between Angela Merkel and David Cameron.
That's right.
David Cameron comes to China. He doesn't mention
human rights. Embarrassing, right.
At all. And Angela Merkel.
Mark Zuckerman of England.
Mark Zuckerberg.
I'm sorry, Zuckerberg. I'm glad I got his name wrong.
And Angela Merkel, I mean, she's consistent with herself, you know, with her East German past.
She's from the East, right.
And she's very much convinced about the importance of human rights. And despite all the importance Germany attached to good economic relations with China, she always makes remarks about it.
And yet efficacy for me seems like a very important measure. I think that, you know, it's one thing to, you know, be able to pat yourself on the back and say, you know, I stood up, that I can look, the satisfying purity of indignation. That's what Obama called it. There is something, you know, but, you know, if browbeating, if that approach yields no results or yields counter, you know, counterproductive impact, is that the right thing? I mean, do we continue to do this? It's just
absolutely not. I think you have to do it cleverly. I spoke to a very left-wing green politician in Germany, and she was very irritated by fellow politicians who just had these declarations about human rights in China all the time. You know, where she knew that because she knew something about China, she knew that the effect on the people in prison was adverse. So it reflected good on the politician, but not on the on the prisoner.
Yeah, you use Ai Weiwei throughout the book as just sort of an example of one approach. Although it's interesting to see how he is moderated recently. If you've seen,
I suspect some kind of deal is struck there. I don't know why. Something happened behind the scenes, I believe.
Yeah, I don't really know what happened.
I have just a quick question that I don't want to forget about. As a journalist, it seems like there's a problem. A lot of what we're talking about is the domain of academia. These are things you write books about that are large in scope, historical scope. But as a journalist, you're dealing with isolated cases. You're dealing with maybe even just incidents that are only of current events interest. You tell a story that's supposed to be mostly, you know, factual. Get the story out. There isn't much leeway to talk about these larger issues. How as a journalist do you, or as a journalist, should push back or try to present a more nuanced narrative in the context of journalism, knowing what we know about the fact that it's a market product, for example? How do you deal with that?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Well, the nice thing about writing this book, I was not confined to any space, and I could write 120,000 words.
Well, you're writing
words.
Meta-journalism here, right?
Yeah. So that gave me a lot of liberty and also in-depth knowledge of the subject. And I think that is really important, you know, for journalists to not just to produce this small story, but try to see the bigger picture. And I think then you get some kind of quality to your journalism, which you eventually need to get this better mutual understanding, which we all crave for.
Can you only do that by building up a body of work, article after article, or is there some other way to accomplish this?
No, I think you have to do it that way. You have to specialize and consistently devote your time to this particular subject and see it from all different angles. Mm. For instance, I just come from Korea, and you know the way they look at China is again different from my European perspective, so I understand it even, you know, we're better or differently again.
Is there a second book in the works now, looking at Southeast Asia or other East Asian and Southeast Asian neighbors of China and how they view it?
Yeah, I don't know yet, but I'm very happy that the first book is there. So
yeah. The other issue that I think maybe is, you know, you start off, you know, you start here with asking the question about, you know, what should then countries like the United States do? Should their stance, their posture toward China be more assertive, be more aggressive, tougher? And in the end, you kind of conclude that no, that kind of a tough posture, a tough stance, you know, by the U.S. and its Western allies would only increase Chinese nationalism, that would spark, you know, an actual second Cold War. Can you walk us through your thinking on that?
Well, yes. I mean, the developments in recent years are quite negative, in my view. If you compare it to when I started the research, there was the Hu Jintao, Wen Jiabao era, and relations were not very good, but not very bad either. And I think due to the question of the Pacific and cybersecurity, the whole espionage thing, I mean, the tensions have increased. You see increasing frustration, even with Obama, who was quite balanced for a long time, but now announcing TPP, he said that it was also a move, you know, not to have a world where China writes the rules. The tendency is going towards a more containment of China and a Cold War policy. And I think, you know, I can't see any advantage of that for both parties. I mean, first of all, and that was also one of the reasons to write the book, is, you know, we have some common problems which we have to solve. And the chance of, for instance, solving the climate crisis is becoming less if you have these two blocks opposing each other. And secondly, in the economic sphere, I think there is very much interdependency has grown over the years so much that you can't compare it to the Soviet Union any longer. You know, the Soviet Union you could contain because economically you were not
exactly, right.
Dependent, and now the U.S. and Europe would shoot in their own foot in a very big way.
That's right.
If they start to contain China.
And yet containment is part of the language with which the Chinese foreign policy community, and especially the Chinese military community, sees American, especially American action. They posit that there is this sort of project of liberal hegemonism, this attempt to thwart China's rise in some way. And I can't help but notice that, I mean, again, this is me, you know, stepping out of my own value perspective and trying to see how Beijing sees things through its window. There have been a lot of essays written recently about the Chinese state and its stepped up repression. They look at, you know, this document number 9. They look at the moves in recent years against the creep of Western values into academia. They look at the crackdown on NGOs and on rights lawyers and things like that. And often this is just explained without reference to the external world, but only within the framework of Chinese politics, that this is an increasingly paranoid, increasingly insecure state, and that its fear is of its own people. Where I think that the way that Beijing would frame this, and I think that it's not without some merit. This argument is not entirely without merit. That they would say, look what's happening in the world. There is this project of liberal hegemonism. It's not necessarily of the neoconservative stripe of overt, you know, preemption doctrine and regime change per se, but it's the left's counter to that. It's the left's counterpart to that, which is, you know, using NGOs, using free press, using internet freedom, using all of these tools.
But it's
a more sinister version of heping yanbian that culminates in bu heping yanbian, like.
Right.
Things like the Arab Spring. They would see the Arab Spring as the culmination of this, color revolutions, you know, prior to that. But I can't help but notice that between September 11th, 2001, and 2008, there was this period of a kind of very relaxed U.S.-China relations because, of course, the U.S. had enlisted China in this global war on terror. And, you know, it had laid off and stopped, and its focus was elsewhere. And during that time, internet censorship wasn't It was bad, but not so bad. There were, you know, NGOs didn't exactly flourish, but they weren't suffering, you know, repression either. Rights lawyers were able to do some of their work. They were, and then, you know, the Chinese human rights record wasn't so bad. I can't help but see these two things as somehow interlinked. The foreign policy environment, the international environment, and it's not just a matter of increased swagger and bellicosity on the part of Beijing that stimulated this, but it's also things like, you know, the pivot to Asia. Mm-hmm. It's also this, you know.
It's a very interesting analysis. I don't know whether cause and effect is that
right, hard
clear,
to
and I think if you want to explain the way the domestic situation has evolved, I don't know how important this foreign context really is. I would start by the person of Xi Jinping and his wish that the party will survive, and therefore the party has to have all the ground possible, and that the civil society should decrease and become less important. I think that is for me, that is the starting point. And then they can find arguments in these external developments. Mm. To my feeling, it's not the essence of the last 3 years.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I think that.
Yeah, I would say again, Xi Jinping also does seem to mark. It could be a coincidence, but he came around the same time, post 2008, although a few years after that. It seems to me that this has become at least increasingly marked during Xi Jinping's regime, or if that's the right word.
Mm. Well, that's a wonderful topic for another another podcast. But we're coming up here on time. I think it's probably let's make sure that everyone knows the title of the book once again. It's called China and the West: Hope and Fear in the Age of Asia, by Foka Obema. And we want to thank you very much for taking the time to come on. And now move on to you'll stay and make a recommendation with us, I hope. David, what is your recommendation for the week?
Yeah, moving to sort of a macro level from the messy daily political situation to the sort of looking at us as a human race, I've been reading lately a book called Sapiens by someone named Yuval Noah Harari.
Mm-hmm.
And what it is just the history of Homo sapiens, from the very beginning to the present time, and very detailed, and it's an evolutionary account, obviously, and taking into account the sorts of... There's been a lot of interest lately because of this...
New
discovery of the Homo Naledi, or whatever. Naledi. And also the Homo Florensis, or whatever. There's been several different types of
Florensis
Homo
was
discovered.
In Indonesia, right?
But it's a very different... It's a very interesting book that goes through the cognitive history to show how we developed some of these cognitive capabilities, and including moral and social characteristics of our particular species of ape.
I love this kind of book.
It's a great book that very very much detailed, very chronological. And if you're a political scientist, I think it makes an interesting reading because it tells us more about the roots of these messy sort of human behaviors that we've been talking about.
Wow, great. And you'll make sure that you get our intern Ben the correct spelling of this name.
That's the problem, yes.
Right. Okay, good. Foka, what do you have for us?
Well, the book I would recommend is maybe a bit old one, but I think for Chinese readers still very interesting. The Circle by David Eggers, which I just read. And a couple of months later, I stumbled across a very interesting Chinese story, which is about a social credit system. I don't know whether you know about that.
Yeah, of course. I mean, we've been debating this hotly with a lot of people late. I mean, because, you know, our mutual friend, Rogier, I keep saying his name.
Kramers.
Rogier Kramers. Right. Because he wrote, you know, he translated that whole thing. I think that there's been a lot of misunderstanding about what this actually is.
Okay. But Well, as far as I understand it, it's rating your behavior, giving your a certain, as a civilian, a certain number of points, and that would be then important for not only your credit, but also for getting housing, getting jobs, whatever. It's kind of scary, and it gives you an idea of a totalitarian approach. But at the same time, it's interesting to see that in the West, you know, it's similar developments take place. It's only not with the state involved, but just companies.
Well, the thing is, we don't know that there's any state involvement in this. We have a document that
in China, you mean?
Yeah, in China. We don't know that there's any state involvement. We know that there's this document. And we know that there are these systems that have been implemented by Alibaba and by Tencent, which may have nothing whatsoever to do with the other. There's no clear linkage between the two.
Yeah.
And okay. I mean, until somebody shows me evidence that there is, I'm not going to assume that there is.
Okay. Okay.
I think it's an interesting story, and I'm going to continue to follow it closely.
Yeah. Anyway, the circle.
The Circle, right. Dave Eggers, right. Dave Eggers, who a staggering work of, a heartbreaking work of staggering genius, and a number of other novels. A brilliant writer, not kind of an uneven, but generally pretty enjoyable writer for me. Yeah. And The Circle is about sort of a dystopian social network, right?
Absolutely.
A Google-like, yeah. Maybe I really ought to read that.
Sure.
Right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Laboring as I do in
you
the belly
be the
of
the first reader of this book.
I should, absolutely. No, it's been on my list for a long time. I don't know how I haven't gotten around to it, but I have meant to read it. My recommendation, also a book. I mean, we're all going with books this time, but... okay, so people who listen to this podcast know that I've been working my way through the Will and Ariel Durant Story of Civilization series, and now I'm on volume 10, which is so far the best one. It's called Rousseau and Revolution. This one actually won a Pulitzer for general nonfiction for Will and Ariel Durant. Everyone's parents have these, enormous, 12 volume set. It's 11 or 12 volumes, but it's an amazing piece of writing that somebody could have sustained this level of brilliance across that many, you know, millions and millions of words. It's the erudition, the narrative style, the verve with which this is told. This one covers basically, you know, the Salonniers, the Philosophes in Paris in the mid 18th century. You know, it covers a lot of the same ground as chapter 9, volume 9 before it, which is the Age of Voltaire. But this, you know, looks at Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who I've come to have an abiding loathing of. I really just cannot stand the man or his works, you know. But it also, great
we
chapters
read
on
it anyway.
Frederick the Great. No, absolutely. Because I think that Rousseau is just so important to who we are as people. I mean, you know, the romantic response to the Enlightenment, I think, is incredibly important. But it's an amazing book. It covers the whole Catholic South. It covers the Islamic East. It looks at, of course, all the countries of the Protestant North. And in the whole prelude up to 1789. And so
you're listening to it as an audiobook.
I am listening to it as an audiobook.
That's a lot of reading of millions and millions of words, too.
It is. Stefan Rudnicki. Listen to his readings of it.
He has a lot of supply of cough drops.
He does. His voice is great. It's just his ability to read, and his pronunciations of a lot of different languages, of French and of Spanish and of are pretty admirable for somebody who's obviously, a stolid American. But great one. I'm looking forward to the next one, which is The Age of Napoleon, which I hope to as well. So I like to read these in audio, but also to have them in text so that I can kind of go back and forth between. So if it's too noisy to listen, like on the subway, I can read. And if I'm driving or if I'm in a cab, I can listen. Well, if I don't want to bother my wife at night with having a light on while I'm reading. Anyway, thanks, guys.
Okay.
Thanks. It was
a
great discussion, and I highly recommend the book. I think I have a copy of it. It's signed to me, but maybe we can finagle another copy of it to give away to one lucky reader, if we can get you to part with the warm copy. Will you assent to that, Fuka? Yes? Yes. Okay, good. Very good. So then we will. I'll announce some kind of contest-like device whereby we will reward somebody with a copy of this book. Thanks very much for listening, and we will see you next week on the Seneca Podcast. Take care.